We are here in Mark chapter 6. We just finished looking at the story of or the event recorded. The Williams are here. Hello, Paul, Harold and Paul. About the feeding of the 5,000 and some very good discussion we had on that last week. Today we are going to look at Jesus walking on the water. This is a miracle, another miracle recorded by John that's found in some of the other gospel accounts, and that is a very peculiar thing. John only records seven specific miracles of Jesus, aside from the resurrection, of course. And we note that two of those are in John chapter 6, the feeding of the 5,000. He is walking, John records walking on the water, all this in John chapter 6, and he is doing this, and then along with the feeding of the 5,000, and then the walking on the water takes place just after that. So we're going to look at that today. Again, another miracle recorded in the Gospel of John. Again, very unusual to see this. Of the seven miracles, two of them we find in the other gospel accounts. All right, so before let's go ahead and read this passage now as we begin this class, or as we continue in this class. All right, so this is Mark chapter 6, starting in verse 45, and we will read to the end of the chapter, verse 56. So let's read. Immediately, he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he sent the multitude away. And when he had sent them away, he departed to the mountain to pray. Now, when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land. Then he saw them straining at rowing, for the wind was against them. Now, about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea and would have passed them by. And when they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were troubled. But immediately he talked with them and said to them, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." Then he went up into the boat to them, and the wind ceased, and they were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure and marveled. For they had not understood about the loaves, because their heart was hardened. When they had crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret and anchored there. And when they came out of the boat, immediately the people recognized him, ran through the whole surrounding region, and began to carry about on beds those who were sick, to wherever they heard he was. Wherever he entered, into villages, cities, or the country, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and begged him that they might just touch the hem of his garment, and as many as touched him were made well. We're going to first look at locations, timing, and conditions. And one of the passages we'll look at is John chapter 6 and verse 19. As we see here, it says that in verse in Oh, in verse 44, they are heading to Bethsaida, and so we note that Luke records that they were already in Bethsaida at this time. So it stands to reason that there are in fact two Bethsaidas. So I have on here the locations of these things. We have Bethsaida, Galilee to one side. Let's see if I can move this. And Bethsaida Julius on the other. Bethsaida Julius is the one that most of us are familiar with. That's where we understand that Philip is from, the disciple Philip. And we know that it's very likely that Andrew and Peter are originally from there as well. And so but Bethsaida Galilee is where they appear to be at this moment. While they did the loaves and the fishes, while they did that, the feeding of the 5,000. And so they are attempting to go on over to Bethsaida Julius, and that's about a distance of about 4 miles, and that's very interesting. When Jesus comes to them, they were in the middle of the sea. John says they were about 3 or 4 miles out, and that's in John chapter 6, verse 19. It said, I think, 25,000 to 30,000 stadia, which is a Roman measurement of distance, and converting that is about 3 or 4 miles. And so they're trying their best. They're struggling. Of course, they can't unfurl their sails to head to Bethsaida. So they are struggling at rowing. They've got a row over there, but even that is very difficult for them while the wind is so strong upon them. And so they end up, and it says, in the midst of the sea, in verse 47, the boat was in the middle of the sea. Now, we could take that literally, or we could say, oh, they just mean somewhere out in the sea somewhere, not near the shore. But it seems to be fairly literal here, being in the middle of the sea, especially if they are about 3 or 4 miles out from the shore, out from where they were. And Jesus is there at this point. And let's see. There is a bit of a storm that we see. The winds are against them. It's not as bad as the storm that we see in chapter 4, where Jesus calmed the wind and the waves. But the wind was against them. They were straining at mowing, at rowing, excuse me. So instead of going to Bethsaida Julius, they end up drifting further and further into the sea. And it says that this event was happening. It started perhaps at evening, perhaps after the sun had set. And then it says that Jesus arrives at their boat at the fourth watch of the night. So the question is, when is the fourth watch of the night? The fourth watch of the night is in between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. So the night was divided into four watches, whenever the guards would change every 3 hours, and this would start around 6 o'clock, 6 p.m. So these events occurred in the wee hours before dawn, again between 3 to 6 a.m. Jesus got into their boat, the wind ceased, but instead of going to Bethsaida Julius, they must have changed their minds. I mean, look at the distance between Bethsaida Julius and their position in the middle of the sea. And they must have changed their minds and decided, we note in verse 53, they end up going to Gennesaret, which is on, for those listening, that's on the eastern, or rather the western shore of the Sea of Galilee, toward the northwestern side there. And so that's a region there called Gennesaret. And that seems to be a little bit closer. Now, the conditions, we should consider the conditions. The book of John notes that this is around the time of Passover, a little bit before the Passover. And the Passover is determined, the time of the Passover is determined by the full moon. So when the full moon occurs, that's when the Passover is. So we see that the Passover, that this is a time when the moon is close to being full. It's not full yet, but it is close. And so when the moon is full, it is up throughout the entire night. And we know how bright things are at night when the moon is full. I've been doing some walking late at night lately, and the moon isn't full. It is about first quarter. It's about a half moon right now. And it is very bright in the dark places. So even then, we see that it is dark. Oh, that is very bright at that point. So we're at probably, if you're familiar with moon phases, in the waxing gibbous phase, and perhaps very close to the full moon. And so it's not quite full, but it's getting there. And so so we note that they are looking at things, that the 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock hour, it's possible that that the moon has set by this point, because again, it's very close to being full. But we also have the idea of the pre-dawn time, sort of that false dawn that we're dealing with. And so, as they see Jesus coming, it is this they believe it to be some kind of apparition. And so we'll get to that in a moment. So the lighting is very important for this particular event, at least for us to picture it, to understand what's going on here, why they could even see Jesus. But before we get to that, let us consider some other interesting things here. Oop, there we go. Let us consider some other interesting things here. For instance, Jesus prays. Jesus prays. He just fed the 5,000 here. He just fed the 5,000. He sent everyone, and the disciples and the multitudes away, so that he could have a moment to pray by himself. He sent the multitudes away. They go off somewhere, and the disciples, they go off on a boat, heading toward Bethsaida Julius. Now, it's possible, we know, if we remember, from Capernaum to Bethsaida Galilee is about a half hour, so Jesus could easily walk to Bethsaida Julius if he should decide to. But that's not what ends up happening. But Jesus, he ends up praying here. And we see that he prays often. And many times his prayers were lengthy, that are not that are necessarily recorded, but they're mentioned as being very lengthy in the New Testament. Here, his prayers must have lasted for hours. We see on the PowerPoint here, I have Mark 1:35, where he prayed there before beginning his ministry, before really beginning that in earnest. And then we see in Luke 5:16 that he prayed often in the wilderness, and also in Luke 6:12 where he prayed all night before choosing who his disciples, who the apostles were going to be. He prayed often. Again, this lasted for hours, and I'm assuming it lasted from around evening to about 1 a.m. And the reason why I say that, if he got off the boat by, or if he got onto the boat rather, by around 3 o'clock, which is very possible. It could have been sooner, or it could have been a little bit later than that, but I'm assuming the least amount of time. If he got onto the boat by 3 o'clock, assuming he had a normal stride of about 2 miles per hour, maybe a little bit faster, then that would make about 4 miles, which places him leaving the shore at around 1 o'clock in the morning. And so he could easily see all of that because it is, again, it is the moon is bright, it's nearly a full moon, and he could see, on a clear day, you can see. From what I understand, anyway, you can see the entire shore of the Sea of Galilee, from any point on the Sea of Galilee. So you can actually see all of that. And so if so, Jesus being able to see about 3 or 4 miles out, especially in the light of the full moon, he can see where the disciples are, and he heads in that direction. If he's walking at a normal pace, of course, it might take a couple of hours to get to the boat. So the first question I have on here is, through all of this, all the things that we see happening, when did Jesus and the disciples have time to sleep? When did they have time to sleep? They went straight from Bethsaida, rowing all night. They ended up in Gennesaret, and it says immediately that the crowds recognized him, and it was about the early morning, about 6 o'clock. There are no doubt people awake, people fishing, people doing all sorts of things, and people see him and they drop everything and they come out and want to be healed, or want their friends and family to be healed. They may have slept in the shifts. They may have slept in the boat, perhaps in shifts, but I imagine that can't be very restful. Although we do note that the last time we saw Jesus on the Sea of Galilee with the calming of the winds and the waves, he was sleeping very well. He was sleeping through that storm. So we do see that. So I imagine, though, it must be very difficult to make it through all that. So when do you suppose they had time to sleep? They were going nonstop at this point. Imagine the dedication that they must have had for this, and how tired they must have been afterward. You know, we all need to sleep. Jesus, while he was God or is God, he is also man and fully man and needs his rest. But he managed to be able to do this throughout all the fatigue and the tired and being tired as he must have been. Of course, I don't know about you. If he's praying into the night, perhaps, and it's a speculation, perhaps he might have dozed a little bit while he was praying. I know that happens to me sometimes if I'm praying late at night. But for Jesus, we do note that he was kind of angry with the disciples a little bit later on for not being able to stay up with him while he was praying. So perhaps that wasn't the case. Perhaps he was able to stay awake. But again, just a thought I wanted to put in your mind. And if you had any thoughts on that, man, I'd love to hear them. All right. So next, let us look at what I call on here the ghostly walk. The ghostly walk. We note that he does come to them, that Jesus comes to them. And the Greek indicates that he had every intention of walking right by them. We see that in verse 48, the last phrase in the New King James, and would have passed them by. He had every indication of walking past them. We see that he wanted to pass them by. That's what the Greek indicates. So why do you think he was planning to walk past them? He wasn't planning to get into the boat. So just a discussion question. If you have any thoughts, Sam, or anyone on the phone, or anyone on the chat.
Place of Stephen where he says the answer is we don't know.
Well, but the point is, it's good to try to see if we can figure out that question, if there is some possible reason that we might be able to gather from that. Well, there are a couple different thoughts. There are a couple different thoughts, possibilities as to how and why this happened. Perhaps it's late enough that the moon has set and he just couldn't see them. And he just kept on, he was continuing, planning to keep on going. But that doesn't seem likely, that because of the how bright the moon was, and by the time the moon had set, it was likely the pre-dawn time, the pre-dawn sky. Having a nearly full moon and all that, it seems unlikely that he didn't see them by this point. In fact, it does say that he does see them a little bit earlier on. In verse 48 at the beginning of that verse, he saw them straining. So that seems unlikely. Although conditions could have changed by the time he got to that boat. Perhaps Jesus knew that they could handle their situation on their own. He knew they could handle it. He knew that the Lord was helping them. He knew that God was on their side, that they were able to make do with that. So that is indeed a possibility. And yet they still cry out. They say, "Oh, it's a ghost." And so he decides to climb into the boat to assure them that he is not, in fact, a ghost. Perhaps, though, as some speculate, this is a reference to God going past Moses in the cleft of the rock in Exodus 33, or Elijah in the cave in 1 Kings 19. He goes right by them, and this is an indication that he is on the water. and passing over the waters. Perhaps also a reference to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2, the Spirit hovering over the waters. While Jesus is not the Spirit, we do see a connection there in that they are both God. Whatever the case, the disciples, they think that they see a ghost. In Greek, this is the word phantasma. And you know, we get the word phantasm or even phantom from that. This is an apparition or some kind of a specter. Yeah, Pam says maybe he just wanted some alone, more alone time to pray. Maybe that's the case. Another reason why he might have passed them by. So understandings of ghosts and things of that nature. Now, in our age of reason, if you will, we are very skeptical as to the existence of ghosts. Most of us will say, oh, well, ghosts don't exist. Of course, there is a certain group who will absolutely insist that they exist. In fact, there are even ghost tours in Charleston, and I'm sure in some other places. And I don't know how much the tour guides believe in those ghosts or not, but they certainly put on a good show. It's good for entertainment, things of that nature. But generally speaking, we don't believe that ghosts are real. It's in a lot of our fiction. But their understanding of ghosts is not from our cultural understanding of ghosts, because you know we have our you know, why is a ghost still around, and we have our speculation if indeed, you know, in fiction, I mean. And though they were much more widely believed in back then, because they were not in what we sometimes arrogantly call the age of reason. whatever the case, they were disembodied spirits. They believed, or they understood ghosts to be disembodied spirits of people who died by suspicious means, or perhaps weren't buried properly. And so we have an understanding of that too. You know, if somebody died suspiciously from foul play, you know, they're out to haunt the people and try to solve the murder so that their bodies can rest and their ghosts can finally move on. You know, that's the kind of thing that we see in fiction today in our understanding of ghosts. But at the same time, this is what they understood that as well in their works of fiction and in some of their more fantastical and legendary things. Yes.
I think Luke 24 has an interesting little light to shine on this. So this is Jesus after the resurrection, verse 36. It says, "Now as they said these things, Jesus himself stood in the midst of them and said to them, 'Peace be to you.' But they were terrified and frightened and supposed that they had seen a spirit. And he said to them, 'Why are you troubled? And why do doubts arise in your heart? Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have.' And then he shows them his body, and he eats with them, and they believe him." It's just interesting there that Jesus himself references a contrast. And they were obviously, it says that they thought they'd seen a spirit, and he says, "Nope, spirit doesn't have flesh and bones, and here, see, I have flesh and bones." So there's some interesting tidbits. It's sort of like angels. You know, we'd love to have a whole book on everything to know about angels. We'd probably like to have a book, everything to know about spirits. But the Bible doesn't tell us a whole lot, but it tells us what we need to know.
I'm trying to look up what the word for spirit that is in that passage, and it's probably pneuma. Yeah, it's pneuma. So this is a different. I say that there are some sources, and I look this up. Some sources will say that there was some ancient sources will say there's no difference between a spirit and a pneuma and a phantasma. Or things of that nature, no, or a soul. Some people will conflate all of those things into the same understanding, and maybe that's how the New Testament writers are using it too. But this is the only instance, at least this this event, because it's recorded in the other gospel accounts, the only instance where the word phantasm is used, or phantasma. So this might be a different understanding, something more spooky, something more scary, because again, this is a different, a somewhat different situation here that we see.
They were scared, that's for sure.
Yes, both cases they were very scared. All right, so let's see. I found a very interesting paper on this about different instances in ancient mythology about, or in ancient stories about ghosts and things of that nature. They were typically seen in dimly lit areas in the wee hours of the morning. And what do we have here? A dimly lit area in the wee hours of the morning. And so that's maybe they're thinking, oh, this is the time, what is commonly called the witching hour. This is the time when the ghosts are out and we are possibly seeing one here. But there's one curiosity here. In the ancient world, it appears that water is actually a weakness for ghosts. We tend to think of ghosts as floating around and doing all sorts of things and not being hindered by physical barriers and things of that nature. But back then, they understood water to be a kind of barrier. It serves as a boundary and can mean the end of a ghost. In fact, sometimes there are the end of a ghost in some mythology is that they sunk into the ocean. And so we see that water is kind of the enemy of a ghost, if you will, a weakness, kind of like their kryptonite, if you will. So it would be silly, pretty silly for the disciples to think that this was a ghost on the water. This is emphasized by Mark in verse 52 by saying that their hearts had been hardened. The hardening of the hearts of the disciples, especially coupled with something as obvious as the feeding of the 5,000. They're just not seeing this. They're not, they're so looking at the only people, in fact, in ancient mythologies, the only ones who could walk on water were gods, God-gifted rulers, and divine men. So this would have been another major clue to the disciples, and especially to Mark's largely Roman audience, that this was no ghost. This was no ordinary man. This is someone blessed by the divine. And while it's not concrete proof, but it is, in addition to everything else, they should have seen this by now. And yet they don't. Their hearts are still hardened. Jesus's divinity is even further hinted at with his words of comfort. Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid, of course, is a common phrase said when any spiritual being is seen throughout the scriptures. Fear not. Remember? At the same time, it is I in Greek is ego eimi, which, if you're familiar with that, means I am. So while this isn't definitively Jesus indicating that he is stating that he is divine, it certainly adds to it when you couple that with everything else that's going on here. Ego and me, it is be of good cheer. I am. We note that he states that explicitly in John chapter 8, verse 58. Before Abraham was, I am. He states that explicitly here, but here it's not as explicit, but it is a strong indication of his divinity. Of course, that is the name of God that we see in Exodus chapter 3. Here, Jesus is passing through the waters, like Moses passed through the waters of the Red Sea, as on dry land. Another, like Moses, is here. All right, and now the work continues. The work continues. We see this in the rest in Mark chapter 6, verses 53 through 56. And we see that Jesus climbs into the boat. The wind ceased. But instead of going all the way to Bethsaida, as we mentioned earlier, as they had originally planned, they go to Gennesaret. And as I said, I think the best explanation is that Gennesaret is in fact closer, or at least six in one hand, half a dozen in the other, to where they are at this point than Bethsaida is. Due to their extreme astonishment that we see and the fright that they had, I doubt, I mentioned where do they find time to sleep? Well, I doubt because of the astonishment and all the things that were happening, I really doubt that they found time to sleep after this. And yet, the work continues. We know that the people immediately recognize him, but they don't perhaps recognize him as the Messiah, not just yet, but definitely as a miracle worker. If they had recognized him as the Messiah, of course, they were doing better than even the disciples were at this point. Although many people, as we see later on in John chapter 6, at the time of at the time of the loaves and the fishes, the feeding of the 5,000, we note that they did try to set him up as a ruler. Many of the more zealous people did that, but instead he goes away into the mountains, sends a multitude away. So his popularity had not waned, had not gone down, but it instead increased, especially after word had gotten out that just touching the hem of his garment would bring healing. We remember that, of course, in Mark chapter 5, verses 27 through 29. In that passage, if you recall, the woman with the flow of blood, she said to herself, "If I could just touch the border of his garment," Luke says the hem of his garment, "then I can be healed." And in fact, she was. Her faith saved her. And so many other people realized, "Oh, that'll work. Let me do the same thing. Let me do the same thing." And so they do. So we note in chapter 7 that the Pharisees, they have to stick their nose in it. They have to get involved again in another attempt to knock Jesus down. And I'm done with what I have for the rest of Mark chapter 6. But we do still have a few minutes left. I could continue on with Mark chapter 7, to at least perhaps establish this. It is kind of a lengthy reading from verse 1 to 23. But if we have any comments or anything, anything we'd like to share before we move on, then please let's do that. Any other comments or questions or thoughts before we move on? Again, we only have a few minutes, so there's not a whole lot I can do. All right. So I think what I'll do is I'll perhaps set up what we're going to talk about next week. And this is again where Jesus confronts the Pharisees, or rather the Pharisees confront him first, and then they have some disputes about some of their traditions, some of their traditions. And so we see the word cloud for chapter 7. We can look forward to that coming up. And let's see, we note that he first opposes the Pharisaic traditions. Let's see if I can pull up the introduction here. Remember that the Pharisees, they already had their sights set on killing Jesus. We see that all the way back in chapter 3 and verse 6. And they're even willing to work with the Herodians to do it. And it's clear that they're watching him, seeing if he slips up, even in the slightest. And you know, this reminds me of David. It reminds me of Daniel as well. We know that both of those individuals, David, we see in several of the Psalms, he says, and they look at me and they say, aha, aha. They're trying to find fault in every little thing that he does. And of course, with Daniel, they try to find fault with Daniel, but they can't. And so they have to resort to finding fault with one of the more devout things that he does, and that's praying three times a day, as we see in Daniel chapter 6. And so they try to find this criticism. They try to find the fault in the good. Before, in chapter, the latter part of last event in chapter 2 and the first event of chapter 3, their criticism was based on the law, based on the especially at the end of chapter 2, based on the law of keeping the Sabbath. And of course, there's some traditions mixed in with that. But here we see that this is mostly tradition and not so much what the law states. And in fact, we'll see that particularly in the writings of Josephus, where they not this specific tradition, but some other traditions that are talked about in this chapter. But whatever the case, this is based on their traditions. And as we go on, we're going to see just what place traditions hold for us. We looked at traditions a little bit the idea of traditions back when Sam taught on, I think it was 2 Thessalonians, where traditions are taught. You have kept, or 2 or 1 Thessalonians, one of those, where he says that the traditions have been taught. You know, I handed you these traditions. And there are traditions that we have that are godly and God-given traditions. There's a difference, though, between God-given traditions and man-made traditions. And we'll look at that later. And there's nothing wrong with some of the man-made traditions that we have. But there's a limit. And so we'll definitely look at what that is when we look at Mark chapter 7 next week. So, you know, a tradition that we have is that our order of worship. We have two songs of prayer, a song, Lord's Supper, you know, that kind of thing. That's a tradition that we have. And there's nothing wrong with that kind of tradition. And it helps us fulfill the worship requirements that we see in the New Testament, fulfill the pattern of worship that we see there. But such traditions can become burdensome and could even, in fact, counteract what the law states or what the New Testament for us states. And we'll definitely look at that next week as we move on. Any other final thoughts or questions before we end this at the moment? All right. Very good. So again, thank you all for joining us.